This is a little story about the origins of the name of Captain Rock and the first Captain Rock, a man by the name of Paddy Delane, who was the archenemy of the land agent who managed Viscount Courtenay's estates, 34,000 acres around County Limerick in the early 1820s. And this is supposedly the way in which Paddy Delane came to acquire the name Captain Rock. So the source tells us the peasantry about the hills, viewing the transaction of sending men to repair the road with an eye of jealousy, particularly as none of themselves were to be employed, rose up against the laborers sent by Alexander Hoskins and actually drove them from off the road with stones and sticks. And it was by this activity and the exertions of Paddy Delane on that day that he was called Carriga, or Rock, he being so expert in flinging stones from a gravel quarry at the invaders.
What makes the story of the first Captain Rock sound particularly Irish? The creation of a people's champion in the course of a stone-throwing incident was the beginning, the establishment of a mythical figure known as Captain Rock, who was the avenger of Irish agrarian grievances. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What makes the Rockite phenomenon different from other Irish uprisings? And how big a following did Captain Rock have? And in the end, how successful were they in addressing their grievances? Our guest is James S. Donnelly, is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of Captain Rock, The Irish Agrarian Rebellion of 1821 to 1824, published in 2009 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you very much.
I have to confess, I've never heard of Captain Rock or this particular rebellion. Is it my own ignorance or is it actually not that well known?
Well, what is well known is the succession of agrarian rebellions in Ireland in the late 18th and early 19th century, at least the fact of them. And in the last few decades, most of the major ones have received at least some attention from historians. This was the Rockite rebellion or insurgency or movement of 1821-24 was the biggest so far in a long succession of rebellions that dated back to the 1760s and happened at least once a decade from the 1760s down to the 1820s. In the 30s, the 1830s, the decade before the famine, there was an enormous tithe war, which is probably the single largest agrarian rebellion of the pre-famine period. And then, of course, in the second half of the 19th century, there is what we call the land war of the 1880s and 90s and extending into the early 20th century. But what really attracted me about the Rockite movement of the early 1820s was that it had many distinctive features and that made it stand out from earlier agrarian rebellions. It had not yet been studied in detail. It made, if you would read the Dublin newspapers of the early 1820s, it was the front page story virtually every day. The papers were just loaded with acts of violence and intimidation committed by the Rockites in the seven counties where they were most active. And so it presented itself as an awfully big target for a historian who was interested in this particular phenomenon of agrarian rebellion, agrarian protest. And with Ireland being an overwhelmingly agricultural country in these pre-famine decades, 70% or more of the population involved in agriculture, very bad, strained relations between landlords and tenants, you could say that this was really the center of the action.
Was this phenomenon, if you go back and look at Ireland at this time in the 1820s, this is pre-partitioning off of Protestant Ireland in the north. Is this primarily an Irish versus English, Catholic versus Protestant conflict?
Yeah. It is sectarianism in the form of antagonism and violence between Catholics and Protestants is a huge theme of the 1820s. And of course, if you take this back to the 1798 rebellion, the greatest rebellion of the modern period, apart from the War of Independence between 1919 and 21, that was a very sectarianized affair in which the death toll probably ran in the repression of the rebellion to 25 or 30,000. And in that rebellion, Protestant ascendancy was threatened by a revolutionary uprising that was much influenced by the French Revolution. Radical Presbyterians originally joined with Catholics in opposing Anglican political and economic domination. But there came a point during the revolution, or the attempted revolution, where a split occurred in the revolutionary forces between the Radical Presbyterians and the Catholics. And so the following decades see more or less a consolidation of forces on the Protestant side. You have in the mid-1790s the foundation of the famous Orange Order, which has continued down to the present day. So Presbyterian and Anglican Protestants were both involved in the development, the original development of the Orange Order beginning in the 1790s. So sectarianism is a legacy of the 1798 rebellion in a big way, also of the Great Rebellion of the 1640s. And there are new ways in which Irish society and politics become sectarianized in the 1820s, first by the Rockite movement and then by the Daniel O'Connell-led movement for so-called Catholic emancipation.
These wealthy landowners, are they English?
Yeah, we are talking about a landowning body that may have numbered about, say, 8,000 to 10,000. And in this period, the overwhelming majority of them would have been Anglican in religion. In the north of Ireland, there would have been somewhat significant proportion of Presbyterian landowners, but they really couldn't hold a candle to the economic domination of the Anglican landowning elite.
Can you give us a sense of who owned the land, what they were growing on it, what their grievances were, who was hungry, you know, and sort of give us the scene, the grievances.
You got 2 hours? First of all, it's a very hierarchical structure when you think about the Irish agrarian order. Going from very wealthy landowners like Viscount Courtney, whose agent is the main target of the Rockites at the beginning of this book, who had 34,000 acres. There would be other even larger landowners in Ireland, a fair number who would have had 50, 100,000 acres, and even a few more than 100,000 acres. So you're talking about a landed elite in which the large landowners really tended to dominate the economic and political scene. Underneath the landowners, you have a body of men who are known as middlemen. In the part of Ireland with which I'm concerned, these middlemen were predominantly, even overwhelmingly, Protestant. They would have held anywhere from a few hundred, maybe to a couple of thousand acres. They would have farmed probably small portions of that land themselves, but most of the land they would have turned around and rented out. Those to whom they immediately rented the land would usually have constituted either large or middling farmers, and they would have been a minority of the agricultural population. And those farmers, in turn, the large and middling ones, would have rented land to cottiers and laborers who held at a rent 1, 2, or 3 acres. So the agrarian socioeconomic structure is one with a tremendously broad base and a very narrow apex. So it's a very unequal society with wealth concentrated enormously at the top, and with a huge impoverished population running into the millions at the bottom.
And what are they growing on there,
now,
that land?
There are two basic kinds of agriculture when you talk about Ireland. You're talking about tillage and you're talking about pasture. Now we think of Ireland as the Green Isle, the Emerald Isle, a place that's in which dairying and the raising of cattle and sheep are the predominant agricultural preoccupations. And that's what Ireland mainly became, partly as a result of, and in the aftermath of the Great Famine of the late 40s and the early 1850s. Prior to that time, Ireland had a very expansive tillage economy, growing wheat, oats, barley, and potatoes. Because those on the lowest rungs of the socioeconomic ladder were potato eaters, and because there was not much trade in potatoes, there was a very significant part of the land that was tilled, devoted to tillage or crops, that was given over to the potato crop. Maybe in the south of Ireland, up to 25% of the tillage land would have been cultivated with potatoes.
And this is really just to feed the farmers.
And this is just to feed, potatoes provides approximately 60% of national food needs on the eve of the Great Famine, okay? And there would be approximately 3 out of 8.5 million people who would be totally dependent or almost totally dependent on the potato for subsistence, and another 1 to 2 million who would have been largely dependent on the potato. You can see that, so not quite accurately, but the word monoculture has entered sometimes into the discussion because of this overwhelming dependence on the potato for such a high proportion of the agricultural population. But there was also a thriving trade between England and Ireland, between Britain and Ireland, in what the British know as corn crops, which include wheat, oats, and barley. Of those three crops, oats would have been the one that occupied the most acreage, followed by wheat and then by barley. And at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder, besides potatoes, it was quite common for middling and small farmers, and sometimes even for cottiers with just, say, under 5 acres of land, to devote, if we're speaking of cottiers, 1 or 2 acres, but if we get into small and middling farmers, to devote a substantial proportion of their acreage to these crops, especially during the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, running from the early 1790s down to the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, when there was an enormous wartime need for tillage products in Britain. And so the war pushed up agricultural products of the prices of agricultural products of all kinds, tillage and pasture. But tillage did perhaps particularly well during this boom that lasted for some 25 or more years. The problem now comes with the bust, with the end of the Napoleonic Wars, beginning in, even before Waterloo in 1815, beginning in 1813, the prices of the tillage products, about which you've just asked, undergo 2 catastrophic price declines. The first one between 1813 and 16, when the prices of wheat, oats, and barley decline by anywhere from 40 to 60% over a 3-year period. Then a slight upward adjustment in 1817-19, and then a further precipitate decline in tillage prices, along with most livestock prices, from 1819 to 23. And that brings you to the big economic depression, recession of 1819-23, which is really the major spark for this agrarian rebellion. This is a depression-created rebellion.
The farmers, are they responsible for getting their product to market, say, to England, and then paying cash to the landowners?
Not really, because there was a well-developed merchant trade, a series of middlemen who would have stood between the farmers and exporters in the ports. So, for example, if you were dealing with butter and dairy farming important in the south of Ireland where this movement was very prevalent, the Cork Butter Exchange in Cork City was a world-famous market for the transaction of business in butter. And they used to take the butter that came in from the countryside, and they had an inspection system, and they would put the butter into 6 different qualities and price it accordingly. And then there were merchants who both, 2 sets of them, one who took the butter in from the farmers and a set of export merchants who were separate, who dealt with the merchants who took it in from the farmers. So you'd have to say that both in grain and in butter, as well as in cattle, although that's a little bit more complex, there are a whole series of middlemen who are operating as intermediaries between the people down on the farm, so to speak, and the consumers in Ireland or in Britain.
But as this depression hits, where does the squeeze come for these farmers?
Well, the truth of the matter is that this depression is so far-reaching that there is hardly, you know, any sector of the Irish economy or any kind of producer or middleman who is not squeezed. Everybody is squeezed. And one of the reasons why this particular rebellion is complex and fascinating is because there are so many pressure points along that, you know, hierarchy of land ownership and land holding that I described earlier. I mean, the people at the top are squeezed. The middlemen are squeezed. Since they're being squeezed, they're squeezing the people below them. Farmers are squeezing agricultural laborers and cottiers. When you get down to the bottom, the cottiers and laborers have nobody to squeeze, but, you know, you could see
they squeeze up.
they squeeze up, yeah.
Tell us about the title of your book, Captain Rock, and when this figure first gets referred to.
Well, it's necessary since it's called Captain Rock. That primary incentive or reason for doing so is that the main calling card of the Rockites, who operated very much on the basis of violence and intimidation, beginning usually with intimidation, and when they couldn't bring about behavioral modification, moving on to violence fairly quickly, they engaged in the sending of a classic form of popular protest, namely the threatening letter. This is not an Irish phenomenon by any means. One of the best-known works in English social history, connected with the name of Eric Hobsbawm and George Roudet, is called Captain Swing, about the last laborers' revolt, so-called, in England between 1830 and 1832. They also issued threatening letters, which were signed Captain Swing, and for that reason, not surprisingly, Hobsbawm and Roudet entitled their famous book Captain Swing. This similar phenomenon where the insurgents involved in this particular agrarian rebellion have issued threatening letters by the thousands.
To landlords, mostly? Or?
To just about everybody. Again, people who refused to do. You could think of the Rockites as promulgating an alternative set of laws and to set at naught as much as possible the laws that they felt were oppressing them. And so they issued regulations that were meant to determine the level of rents, the amount of tithes that people would pay, the amount of money that people would pay for potatoes and other provisions, the rates of wages that employers would pay, just about anything that came within the ambit of the wide ambit of grievances of the Rockites was subject, in the Rockites' view of things, to regulation in order to arrive at a kind of moral economy, to use a famous phrase invented by Edward Thompson or put forward by Edward Thompson. So you could think of the Rockites, like other popular protesters, as having a moral economy of their own, which they sought to enforce by the promulgation of a set of regulations. And standing behind those regulations were letters of intimidation or acts of intimidation. And where the letters of intimidation did not secure what they wanted, then they would proceed to violence. I'll give you a clear example which concerns one of their main grievances. You would expect that because of the intensity of this economic depression, a lot of farmers would be unable and or unwilling to pay their normal rents. So shortly after the full impact of this big recession, depression began to be felt, there was, in effect, a widespread refusal to pay the traditional rents without a reduction of 40, 50, or 60%. Very few landlords were willing to concede reductions of that magnitude. So that meant that the tenants who were refusing to pay the rent were then, they usually first had their livestock or their crops impounded, and then with a view to sale in order to defray the unpaid rents. But that was usually only the first landlord gambit, and in case of tough resistance, which is mostly what they met, landlords felt themselves forced in order to pay their own creditors, to engage in evictions or ejectments. They had been benefited by the passage of recent legislation, which made ejectment or eviction much easier and much cheaper. And this was probably the first major Irish agrarian depression, during which the landlords had a cheap means of eviction. Okay, if a landlord evicted, which was completely against the rules of the Rockites, the landlord would be warned that if he evicted a tenant, he could expect that he would suffer accordingly. Either they would shoot him or they would burn down the house in which the tenant occupied. And they shot quite a few landlords and agents during this period, and they burned down a lot of houses.
We'll look at the incident that gave rise to the first Captain Rock when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, James Donnelly, who is informing us about Captain Rock and the Irish Agrarian Rebellion of 1821 to 24, which gave rise to not one, but apparently a series of people named or called Captain Rock who represented these Irish agrarian grievances. And we began the hour with a description of how that first person became Captain Rock. What happens after that point in the story?
Well, his story quickly turns in a different direction because he is apprehended for his involvement in the murder of the son of the hated agent, Alexander Hoskins. And in order to save his own skin, he turns what's called Queen's Evidence and becomes an approver or an informant against his former comrades.
Well, so not exactly a heroic figure.
No, not a heroic figure in the end, no.
So what happens then to get the Captain Rock term reapplied?
Well, that's not a problem because all of these threatening letters that began to circulate appropriated the name Captain Rock and spread the fame of the name across a very wide part of the south and the southeast of Ireland.
And is the name just mostly suggesting that, you know, you can throw rocks? I mean, anything more behind it?
No, no. It's the idea that Captain Rock is the mythical avenger of the whole range of Irish agrarian grievances.
Okay. Do we have any visual depiction of Captain Rock?
Well, we do have some artistic renderings. There's a famous one by Daniel MacLeese, a famous portrait, which I include here in the book. But this wouldn't be an artist drawing of a real Captain Rock.
Conceived. Is this sort of a Superman? Is it a Robin Hood figure? What kind of figure is this?
A figure who is capable of exacting revenge without penalty, I would say, because the main message that the Rockites sought to get across through their violence and intimidation was that their laws were to operate, and what they regarded as the oppressive and unjust system of laws relating to rents and tithes and other things imposed by the Irish legislature were to be of no account. And so they're driving to impose their own set of laws, their own standards of morality on as large a proportion of the population as possible, and through their violence and intimidation to coerce the behavior of as many people as possible to align themselves with Rockite laws. And they use that word law. One of the most interesting sources for the mentality, the consciousness, and the grievances of the Rockites are these threatening letters, which are written by Catholic country schoolmasters and which are sometimes are only partly literate, but often are very literate, and give you an insight into exactly what is driving this insurgency forward.
It's interesting that in that opening description, the Rockites, as they became known, were actually operating first against people of the working class.
Yes.
They were throwing stones at these laborers who were brought in to replace them or to have jobs where they would have had.
Yes. Well, many people in Ireland, many ordinary Irish country people in the middle or toward the lower end of the socioeconomic scale could easily become the enemies of the Rockites as much as landlords, landowners, or land agents, or tithe proctors. Take, for example, migrant laborers. Okay, we've talked about potato cultivation. Well, there were parts of North Cork, Waterford, and Kilkenny where potato growing was very widespread, and that drew migrant laborers from West Cork and Kerry and West Limerick over toward the southeastern part of the country, both at the time of planting and especially at the time of harvest. There was very much a localist ethic that operated, an ethic which said that, if there's a scarcity of food or other resources, or if there's just a limited amount of employment, the people who should have first access to those limited resources are the members of the local community. And if outsiders started to come into the local community and begin to appropriate scarce resources, and of course in a time of economic depression, all sorts of resources are scarce, then they become the targets of Rockite vengeance. Both the migrant laborers themselves and the farmers who employ them. So the Rockites then make a dead set against the farmers, attracting spalpeens or migrant laborers into their locality, and then they beat up the spalpeens themselves.
It's kind of a classic labor management relationship, isn't it? I mean, it reminds me of some of these strikes brought in, to bring in scabs, and then the unemployed workers attack the scabs and that kind of thing. It falls into those lines.
What makes agrarian rebellion in the early 19th century interesting is that you have different kinds of class alliances and oppositions that operate below the level of the landed elite, the landowning class. For the sake of simplicity, you can talk about middling and large farmers on the one side, who constitute a minority of the agrarian population, small farmers, say under 15 acres, cottiers under 5 acres, and laborers on the other side, who constitute the overwhelming majority of the Irish population. Okay, the interests, the economic interests of the middling and large farmers are very often opposed to the interests of the small farmers, cottiers, and laborers. So much of the intimidation and violence that occurs is between the middling and large farmers on the one hand, large farmers being land grabbers, land monopolizers, people who take over evicted holdings, and the small farmers, cottiers, and laborers on the other. So in the Rockite movement, you have a lot of internal class conflict. Okay.
Yes.
But interestingly, you also have class collaboration between the members of those two main groups that I've sketched out there, because on things like tithes, which are taxes paid to Anglican ministers, and on, let's say, the repressive actions of the government forces, the police, the army, the yeomanry, apply generally against Rockite disturbances. This, whenever you get the forces of repression acting on the insurgents, then it tends to not altogether heal those class divisions, at least to close them up a considerable bit. And on the level of, on the question of rents, since you can see that whole question is so complex, there are so many layers between the top and the bottom, the person who stands in the position of being a landlord to someone below him is in the position of being a tenant to someone above him. So this means that when somebody is evicted from their holding, it has certain surprising results. And most of the time, not all of the time, most of the time, even large farmers, who were not themselves the evictors at any rate, sometimes join forces with those lower down the social scale in resisting eviction, because under the impact of this withering economic depression, even though they might be by some objective standard a reasonably well-to-do farmer, this depression has deprived them of their normal means of livelihood, and they themselves are in danger of being evicted by the person who stands above them as a landlord.
And would you see this group, the Rockites, as being organized almost like a militia? And who's sort of calling the shots or even organizing it?
It's a great question, One tendency has been to think of the activists in this particular movement and in others like it as a disaggregated series of local gangs with local leaders who act only in their own local area. Okay, so as representatives of, you might say, a distinctive local community. But it's very clear when you study a big movement like this one that the way in which the movement spreads is so systematic. The way in which it propagates its ideology is, again, so systematic, extending beyond the local, supralocal. And many of the actions, the specific violent actions taken by Rockite bands, involve local leaders and local bodies of Rockites coming together to mobilize in a larger action. For all these reasons, because of the supra-local aspects of the Rockite movement, I would be very much against seeing Irish Agrarian Rebellion, this one and others, as manifestations of local protest, okay? Because there is, especially in the case of the Rockite, but there are other examples of, well, a way in which something that starts locally, and this one starts on a specific estate, and then it spreads to West Limerick, and then it spreads to neighboring counties. And before you know it, all six counties of Munster and the county of Kilkenny are experiencing very similar kinds of agrarian rebellion with the same consciousness operating, the same kinds of threatening letters, the same modus operandi, the same tactics, the same objectives. And so it's very hard to see this as just the result of the operations of a whole congeries of local gangs.
So there is some kind of collaboration going
on.
Yes,
definitely.
Any leadership that you know about?
Well, yes, certainly. I have a whole chapter devoted to social composition and leadership through a variety of sources. One is able to identify some dozens of people by name who acted as either local or regional leaders. And in a significant number of instances, you can actually become pretty certain that these people are not just operating on a local scale, the leaders, but they have connections that there's so-called committees. The authorities talk about the Rockite committees all the time. These committees would have been supra-local bodies that would have tended to bring together the leaders of local communities, local bands, for the planning of joint operations. So there's that, and there's also another phenomenon that's operating here called ribbonism, which takes us back to a legacy of the 1790s. This was more an urban phenomenon and had a different geographical basis, and it was more political than the Rockites were. The Rockites had some political coloration, but the ribbon men, as they were called, were primarily political and sectarian. Well, there's evidence that in the towns, ribbon lodges in the south of Ireland where the Rockites were active came to be reasonably well concentrated and active. And since town laborers were involved in Rockite activities, you can begin to see overlap between the political and sectarian concerns of the so-called ribbon men, who are mainly town-based, and the town-based and town vicinity Rockites.
How did the landowners strike back? Were they coordinated too in their response?
The landowners were largely immobilized by the first full thrust of the Rockite movement in 1821 and 2, with tougher government enforcement of special legislation, the Insurrection Act of 1822, the use of public hangings, and transportation of large numbers of people, either as a result of trials or without trials. The government begins in 1823 and 1824 through public hangings and transportation to get something of a handle on the Rockite movement. Repression tends to become more effective in 1823 and 24. But the magistracy, the landlord class, the landowners constitute local magistrates, they are very often intimidated into inactivity. There are some zealous, so-called zealous or active magistrates, but of course they become the primary targets of Rockite vengeance. And a number of them are either sidelined by wounding or killing, or they're simply intimidated into inactivity. The big houses of the landlords in the south of Ireland become barricaded structures during this period. They have a feeling of being under siege. The bars go up on their windows, the shutters come across, and many of the sources talk about how members of the landed elite forswear their visiting, their usual visiting, and going out at night, and even in the daytime, they go out only packing pistols and so on. So you'd have to say that the local magistracy, on whom initially the government is reliant for the enforcement of the law, is rendered largely ineffective by the intensity of the Rockite outbreak.
Sounds like nobody's making any money.
For a period of 2 or 3 years, landlord rents probably declined by 50% or more in the areas most affected by the Rockite movement. Tithe payments to the Anglican clergy declined by more than half again. Yes, you'd have to say that in the short term, many of the objectives of the Rockites, the lowering of rents, the reduction of tithes, indeed the abolition of tithes is their aim, the setting of wages at higher levels, as I said, the raising of wages, the prevention of evictions, or at least discouraging landlords from carrying them out, many of those objectives are, if not universally, largely enforced by the Rockites.
And you have a chapter called Pastorinian Captain Rock.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
One of the distinctive features of this particular agrarian rebellion, it's not unique to Irish agrarian or political protest, because there was a lot of millenarianism in Ireland during the revolutionary decade of the 1790s.
You mean sort of end of the world or the second coming?
It's a kind of, we can call it a doomsday scenario, okay? The millennium is the idea of the second coming. What this means in practice is the way in which basically the idea of the world turned upside down. So if you have a grossly inequitable, unequal economic order, those at the bottom or near the bottom of that economic order, or those without political rights in a system where political privileges are vested in a small minority, they conceive, under certain circumstances, of the conditions under which everything will be turned upside down. Well, Pastorini is the nom de plume of an English Catholic clergyman of the 18th century who wrote this book that I have in front of me here, a pseudo-scholarly tome. And like many millenarian tracts, it's based on the Book of Revelation in the Bible or the Apocalypse of St. John. And this work by Signor Pastorini, his real name was Bishop Charles Walmsley, and he was the apostolic vicar for the Western District of England in the 18th century, not a welcome figure there in England, as you would expect. It's called The General History of the Christian Church from Her Birth to Her Final Triumphant State in Heaven, chiefly deduced from the Apocalypse of St. John the Apostle and Evangelist. And this is the fifth edition, printed in Dublin in 1813, and there were very many editions of this particular work. Now, it was not this work that ordinary Irish country people were familiar with, but other readers of Pastorini read into part of his work here the prediction that the reign of Protestantism in Europe would be coming to an end at a certain period of time. And these particular interpreters read Pastorini to say that the reign or the rule of the Protestants in Ireland, the Protestant ascendancy, would be coming to an end in 1821 or 1822. Protestant domination in church and state would be over. As a kind of a result, a set of apocalyptic events. When it didn't happen in 1821 or 1822, the millenarian believers shifted it to 1825, the beginning of 1825. And in the dying days of 1825, such was the widespread belief in Pastorini's prophecies in Ireland, and not just in the south and southeast covered by the Rockite movement, but more broadly, that large groups of Catholics and Protestants sat up, it is said, every night during the week between Christmas and New Year's Day in 1825, waiting for partisans of the other side to massacre them.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing that they left it to the other side and nothing happened.
Yes, yes. And so this fellow Pastorini actually became a household name in the south and southeast of Ireland in the early 1820s. And because he was predicting the doom of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy, the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland, this greatly emboldened the Rockites, made them think that in their attacks on the representatives of the Anglican landed elite and the Anglican church establishment, they had God and history on their side, and that their insurgency was part of the fulfillment of Pastorini's prophecy, which predicted doom for the Anglo-Irish landed elite.
We'll find out how successful the Rockite movement was in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Donnelly, and the title of his recent book, Captain Rock: The Irish Agrarian Rebellion of 1821 to 1824. How does this rebellion end?
Well, it ends with a whimper and not a bang. I've mentioned already that the repressive activities of the government were already having some effect in putting the Rockites out of business.
You're talking about the public hangings and
yes, and transportation of Rockites in their hundreds to New South Wales, to Botany Bay in Australia. But just as the Rockite movement begins with a savage economic depression, so it ends with an economic recovery. And more than any other single factor, it is the recovery of agricultural prices beginning in 1824 that play, I would say, the single most important role in the unraveling of the Rockite movement and in its reduction by 1825 and to a kind of banditry, really. And those, especially laborers and cottiers who still want to remain in the game, they really turn bandits against farmers who had once given them a certain degree of support. And so you see in 1825 the Rockite movement running into the sands. But the other thing, and we can talk about this a little bit because this goes to the question of legacy and consequences, is that just at the time that the Rockite movement is going out of business, the great mass political movement led by Daniel O'Connell for Catholic emancipation, the granting of political rights to Catholics, is gaining ground. And you could argue that much of the popular energy that previously had been invested in the Rockite movement is now transferred through this skillful political manipulation of O'Connell and his lieutenants and this mass organization called the Catholic Association into a very powerful political mass movement. And O'Connell is a bridge between these two things in ways that I can explain if you'd like.
Well, if you look at the points that the Rockites were attacking, like they didn't want the tithing, they didn't want the evictions and so on. How many of those points back when the economic recovery came in, how many of those points actually fell in their favor?
Yeah. Well, I would draw attention to two in particular. Okay. I've mentioned that they assaulted the tithe system, these taxes paid to the Anglican Church by Anglicans, Catholics, and Presbyterians. The reform of the tithe system really begins in 1823 as a result of Rockite pressure. Some significant concessions to the Rockite demand for the abolition of tithes are made. Tithes are not abolished in 1823. They are abolished, however, in 1835. And the way to the abolition of tithes in 1835 is really set by the Rockite movement of the early 1820s.
So they succeeded there.
They really, you know, moved the ball along, I would say. The other thing that's important is the Rockites were so forceful in trying to play defense against evictions that though evictions took place on a numerous scale in the early 1820s, and you could say at certain points later, there were no mass evictions, no clearances, such as occurred in Ireland during and as a result of the Great Famine of the late 1840s and the early 1850s, when hundreds of thousands of people were evicted from their holdings, when popular resistance to eviction completely collapsed because the social cohesion that made resistance possible was obliterated by the Great Famine. I would argue that the Rockites and their successors stood as a barrier against the kind of really mass evictions, clearances, that landlords carried out in the 1840s. In other words, landlords and landowners were frequently made to think twice or a third time before they evicted because the certainty of revenge was so likely.
On the back of your book, it mentions that you draw on a wealth of sources, the reports of policemen, military officers, magistrates and landowners, newspapers, pamphlets, parliamentary inquiries and such. I'm curious, after all the research you did for this book, what did you find surprising about the Rockites and this particular rebellion?
I found Pastorini very surprising. The millenarian aspect of the movement that we talked about before was probably the first thing that grabbed me back in the mid-1970s when I first poked my nose into these sources, because I had never expected to find that. And other historians had, if they had been conscious of the name of Pastorini, they always said, oh, he didn't matter, when in fact, when you took a close look, he mattered a great deal. And then subsequently, of course, Irish historians have become conscious of the role of millenarianism in other movements, particularly earlier ones, and particularly during, especially its role in the revolutionary decade of the 1790s. So if I had to pick one thing, I would say it's the millenarian aspect of the movement. The other thing that fascinated me was the way in which you could have within the same movement cross-class collaboration of people whose interests on some grounds were antagonistic, but in other cases, such were their antagonisms that you had sharp class divisions. So here you have a big agrarian movement that is so big that it actually accommodates as a, you know, wide space for a lot of class collaboration on certain issues and a lot of sharp class antagonism on other issues, besides that fundamental antagonism between the rulers and the ruled.
The Great Famine that you've already referred to, that probably people know more about than any of these other situations in Irish history, how did that affect the whole dynamic between landlord and farmer and all those middlemen?
Yeah. Well, in a big way, because there had been a movement, gradual, for the elimination of middlemen prior to the famine as part of what might be called the reform of estate administration. But a very, very high proportion of the remaining middlemen went to the wall during the Great Famine themselves and were basically liquidated by the landowners as part of the assertion of a new kind of agrarian order in Ireland as a result of the famine. So middlemen are taken out of the picture. That makes a big difference. Furthermore, the famine is the beginning of the gradual disappearance of the agricultural laborer. When you go from a largely tillage economy, which is labor-intensive, to a pastoral economy, which is land and capital-intensive, you need less and less labor. So as Ireland became Britain's cattle and sheep ranch and its dairy store, there was much less need for agricultural laborers than there had been before. So those smallholders and those laborers who survived the famine are the ones who not only got on the emigrant ships during the famine itself, but who continued to get on them through the remainder of the second half of the 19th century. so that the agrarian order in Ireland by the time of the land war of the 1880s and 90s is very different. Different, and if I could epitomize it, before, in the days of the Rockites, you had all those different levels in between the landowner at the top and the occupying tenant at the bottom. By the time you get to the land war of the 1880s and the 1890s, it's the occupying tenant, and usually medium and large tenants, against the land-owning class. And so the land war becomes a war for the elimination of landlordism altogether, and a successful war.
Our guest has been James Donnelly, taking us into rebellion. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. That was fun.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join Norman Gilliland and me for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll look at the Victorian novelist George Gissing, largely forgotten today, but a novelist with a good deal to say and a distinct way of saying it. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.